Much of photographer Gideon Mendel's career has been devoted to documenting the effects of flood, fire, disease on communities around the world. His longest-running body of work is entitled Drowning World, and it features in Auckland's Festival of Photography, currently on the Queen's Wharf fence and in video form on a screen outside Auckland Central Library on Lawn Street. Those of you not able to get there can see his remarkable work on our webpage. Many people gazing straight at the camera surrounded by devastation. Horrific and beautiful and strangely calm. Gideon Mendel's work has been widely published, much awarded, particularly for its documentation of the impact of climate change on individuals in many countries, 13 in the case of Drowning World. And he joins me now from his home in Hackney in London, I think. Hi, Gideon.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on your show.
Look, it's a pleasure. Drowning World began, what, 17 years ago?
No, 2007. I think that's like 14 or 15 years ago, sorry.
Long enough, though.
Not long enough, yes.
And a lot of miles racked up in the process. Yeah, just tell me, people who are looking at these pictures of people standing, I mean literally submerged, in the floods that have inundated their homes, can you tell me the circumstances under which you took those photos?
Well, I mean, every flood is different. So there's no, you know, and the kind of logistical challenges in each situation are complex. My preference is to be, you know, standing in the water with people. In some situations, it was a complex arrangement to bring people back to their homes arrange the photographs. In some situations, we were just in communities and people were there, sometimes, you know, rescuing stuff, looking at the homes. In Brazil, in Rio Branco, we found a lot of people, because the water level was going down, they were using the floodwaters to clean their walls because they knew there wouldn't be any water once the water had gone. You know, it's always a different challenge finding people and making these images. Often they arise, out of quite complex logistical arrangements. But, I mean, I think what your audience obviously can see is that they're sort of disquieting in that people are gazing directly at the camera and they kind of taken in, they're quite conventional portraits of people engaging the camera, but the circumstances are extraordinary. You know, the context is one of kind of extreme flood. And I think you normally expect photographs of those situations to show people fleeing or, you know, doing something about the flood, but there's a kind of peculiar calmness to them.
Because I guess they can't do anything until the water goes.
Exactly. Some people have often described the experience of having a home flooded as being, you know, almost in a weird dreamlike state. You know, there's, you know, you have reflections inside your living room. It's a very peculiar scenario. And, you know, exactly. And in actual fact, the nightmare, the horror of it often begins once the water goes, because then you're dealing with the destruction and the smell and the mold and, you know, all the damage that the water leaves behind. But while the water's there, it's often strangely beautiful.
In the case of the people that you take back to the scene, what you say, excuse me, would you stand in the water up to your shoulders and let me take your photograph? And they presumably say, why? What do you say?
Again, every circumstance is different. Yes, the pictures are kind of staged in the sense that I do, you know, these are their real homes, that is their community and their home. But I do kind of position people, you know, in the place that kind of, in the arrangement which works best visually. So there is a kind of element of staging to it, although the circumstances are very real. I think people actually appreciate having what's happened to them being witnessed. There's a sense that, this is a kind of disaster. I mean, obviously not everyone agrees, but I'd say, a lot of people who are approached and asked to photograph are very, very open to the idea. I offer perhaps a kind of deep witnessing of what's happened to them.
Do they themselves feel as if they are part of the big climate change story?
Again, I can't give an overall answer. I think many do, and many speak quite directly about that. I mean, sometimes people talk about the weather changing locally, if not in a kind of global sense. I think the majority of them there's often a lot of anger. In communities, people often feel let down by local politicians, by administrators. There's often a lot of blame and anger, and certainly many, many of them kind of see themselves as being victims of climate change. I think the discourse, over the time I've been doing, I began in 2007. Over that time, the discourse around climate change has changed, and certainly in my more recent work on on fire, done in the last sort of 3 years, I'd say the majority of people have got very strong opinions on climate change.
You said something interesting in one interview. You said that when you began this project, you thought that the image of climate change was very white, glacial landscapes, polar bears on icebergs. It was very beautiful, but very distant. And your project was to literally bring it home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what I've said before is that when I began this project, it began at a time when I had young children. And I actually sort of did a lot of research and thinking about trying to imagine the world they'd be living in when they're my age. So I was kind of just trying to imagine and also research what the world was likely to be like in 2050 or 2060. And I, began to think more and more about climate change, and I researched the way it was kind of being imaged. And I felt there was a real, at that point, I think this has changed, but at that point, there was a real lack of images which showed the human dimension. So I wanted to produce something which was visceral, where you saw where the victims of climate change were directly engaging the viewer, and that's which is why I chose portraiture, because I wanted the people in my images to be looking the viewer directly in the eye. And I think what's very important to me as well is that in the images, my subjects are not victims. I don't want them to kind of come across as pathetic victims. And they are empowered and powerful. That's very important to me.
They are very beautiful. You will be accustomed, not you personally, but you will know the expression disaster porn, and you will be familiar with criticism for what's being called the aestheticization of a human crisis.
Sure.
Is that justified by the larger cause of drawing attention to climate change?
I mean, I totally hear those kinds of criticisms, and I think, certainly in a lot of the work, I've also been prior to this worked a lot in photographing issues around HIV and AIDS, and one walks on a kind of tightrope in these kinds of things, because there is the obvious danger of kind of being seen as or being, on some level, a kind of disaster vulture, kind of waiting, making our work, about, what draw, what is it that draws us to such traumatic situations?
Well, profiting from people's misfortune, I suppose, at the most basic level.
Yeah. I guess that's the accusation. I mean, I think in my own case, I mean, I certainly wouldn't say, I think if one's talking about kind of financial profiting, I think I would be a much richer photographer if I'd taken a more commercial route. This isn't something which, it's always a challenge to fund it. It's always a challenge to make the work I do. And and keep it going, which is something which I do really aspire to do. I think for me, it's important to make images which people want to look at. And I do make images which I suppose are on one level aesthetic and are kind of, you know, the color is beautiful. They are very, very composed. But I feel they can work as what I call tools of visual advocacy. You know, I like to make work which is, you know, I mean, on one level it's kind of, you know, part of the media. It's used a lot in the media. They also kind of sit often quite comfortably in kind of exhibition and gallery contexts. But most importantly of all for me, they are frequently used in different kinds of climate activism. You know, and I've, a lot of my work has been used, and, you know, I've had many different collaborations with organizations like Greenpeace, like Extinction Rebellion, in the UK, kind of Fridays for the Future. So my work, you know, I'm very proud that it's been part of climate activism, and I do consider myself a climate activist.
You've always been, your work has always fitted into the activist category, has it not? Back when you began documenting life under apartheid in South Africa, your country of birth.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think I sort of, as a very young photographer, documented, you know, the kind of final years of the apartheid system, and, you know, the kind of struggle against apartheid and the state's brutal response. And it was a kind of initiation by fire, which I think sort of marked me. And, you know, I've always been drawn to make work which kind of addresses, I think, the most important kind of issues facing my generation.
You mentioned your work with people living with AIDS. Did that begin for you in Africa?
Well, ironically, it actually began in London when I was based in London, and I actually did a project as part of a kind of cooperative of photographers, and we worked with the Terence Higgins Trust at their 10th anniversary to make a project, and it was called Positive Lives, and it was trying to kind of address HIV and AIDS in a different way, you know, as in a non-victimological way. And I made, you know, I think a very important body of work working in an AIDS ward in London at the Middlesex Hospital. That work was widely shown, and it set me on a route of saying, well, you know, it's important to show the work in Africa as well, you know, to make work in Africa as well. So I spent many years, much of the 90s, I was working on documenting the AIDS crisis in Africa. And I was very much part of, I suppose, identified very strongly with the kind of fight for equal treatment to, you know, and equal access to life-saving HIV medications.
Do you think your work, I mean, climate change is one thing, HIV AIDS treatment another, do you think your work made a difference?
It's very hard. I mean, I think photography has been called a small voice, and it's very hard to quantify what things can do. I think the moments, fractional moments, I think I've had in my career where I was part of something, where there was a moment when there was a huge momentum towards, you know, bringing proper HIV treatments to poor people in Africa. And I think my work at that point was part of that wave of momentum. You know, how much, you know, and things, there was a point when things changed dramatically, when, you know, and huge resources went into making that happen, and many, many lives were saved. So I suppose it's at moments you hope that your work is on the right side of history. I mean, my work, you know, for example, recently, you know, I had a number of my images used on billboards around Glasgow for the COP26 summit. I mean, whether that actually has any impact on anyone, looks, who, you know, who knows? Does it affect anyone? You know, you kind of put it out there and you hope. I mean, I think I'm often, you know, looking at where we are. I mean, you know, I suppose you live in Auckland, which has recently declared a climate emergency, and, you know, the festival's chosen to show my work there. I mean, I think we all are so worried and so concerned about where the world is going with climate change at the moment.
What your photographs do is feature people who are not poor and living in Indian villages or Brazilian slums. You've got, I mean, as well as, you've got Jeff and Tracy from Surrey.
I have some of the poorest people in the world, you know, people living in tin shacks in Bangladesh, and I have people living in multi-million dollar houses in Texas. You know, there's a huge diversity of where people come from. And I think what unites them in that moment, in that brief moment of flooding, is the kind of, is their shared vulnerability. I mean, obviously, there are many different, you know, depending on the culture and the place you live, the kind of resources available and the help you have is kind of differ vastly. But we are all kind of vulnerable to climate change. And I think that's something which I'm trying to get across.
It's extraordinary looking at some of these photos. I can't, you know, one is torn between thinking, oh, my Lord, that's so beautiful, and oh, my Lord, that's so bizarre, and oh, my Lord, how terrible for those people, all at once. You must feel that when you're taking them.
Well, I think, I think there's a lot of things which go through my mind. I mean, obviously, when I'm taking them, I'm often actually thinking of very kind of, you know, I have to make the photographs work. There's a lot of technical kind of professional things going on as well. You know, it's part of, you know, creating these images isn't easy. So there's a lot of work and thought going into the kind of the image making. But what's the kind of punctum, the kind of center of the photograph is the gaze. There's a moment of connection. And, you know, they're all strangers to me. I haven't known them very long. But I feel, you know, across time, you know, somehow my lives and their lives have come together to bring me into that moment where we connect through the camera and their gaze. And
this question goes to authenticity, which of course is an indefinable quality these days. But what if you'd used actors? I'm not suggesting you have, but what if you said to someone, look here, I want you to put on these waders and stand up to your underarms in this flood and let me take a photograph of you? If nobody knew, it would have the same effect, right? You would know, and they would know.
I don't think you would get the same gaze. There's something at this. I think there's a I mean, you could accuse me of, you know, of creating a film set. You know, this could all be, I suppose, theoretically made in a film on a film set with the sets created and the water pumped in. I mean, You could accuse me of that. I mean, I suppose there are plenty of photographs of me taken by my assistants documenting me and kind of at work. And I think perhaps if you looked at the film, the water chapters that's showing outside the station, outside the library, in the film, you have a much more of a sense of the kind of the context that the photographs are taken.
Right.
You know, in the film, you see the film is a lot more kind of.
I'm not questioning.
I think what I'm saying is that if you had an actor, someone who didn't belong there, you would not get that kind of connection. You would not get that gaze. There's something in it. I think people do feel the authenticity of the photograph because of the nature of the way people are connecting with the camera.
I understand what you're saying, and I mean, your assessment is nuanced enough to know that. I mean, you must see a lot more in these photographs than the casual observer does. What do you see? You see the people that you had contact with breathe the same air as?
I mean, it's a strange thing. I mean, I think sometimes other people see a lot more than I do, you know, in a way, there's a lot of kind of small details, you know, the kind of the background details of people's lives. Sometimes I actually don't notice when I'm photographing them. People kind of pick them out when they see them.
Mm.
Of course, I have the memory of that moment of taking the picture. But that, in a way, makes me almost too close to it. I think, you know, other people see them quite differently.
A non-flood picture is a post-fire picture. These were the terrible New South Wales 2019-2020 fires in Australia, of course. And you've got a picture of Sharon and Tom Wootton, a.k.a. Yeah, exactly. Swampy Tom.
Swampy Tom, yes. I love Swampy Tom.
What? Who is he?
Swampy Tom lives, and his family live in a small holding close to the town of Cobargo. I mean, just part of. This image is part of, I suppose, another project of mine, which has been my focus for the last couple of years. It's called Burning World, and I've been photographing the aftermath of wildfires. So I've photographed in Australia, Greece, Canada, California, and Colorado in the last couple of years. I mean, in a very different way. I'm not trying to chase the burning flames. It's very much the aftermath of fires. And I've made a set of portraits of people who've lost their homes to fire in a very different kind of way. So Swampy Tom, I met him in Cobargo. He took us to his home, and we actually returned with his family a few days later, and I made the portrait. In fact, I mean, I was working with an Australian assistant, Annette Widditz, also a talented photographer, and we were kind of semi-adopted by Tom and Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
And they in fact, you know, they looked after us, and they actually arranged for us to do many of the other portraits we did. You know, they were very supportive of
us. So their home had burnt down, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they'd lost their home, and they you know, they're amazing people. They had no insurance. They kind of lost pretty much everything.
They live? Where did they go after that?
They lived with their children. You know, their daughter had a home in the nearby town Cobargo. They had a move in with their daughter, and they are back home now. They have been slowly rebuilding. Their son Jack Wootton was actually a film student in Sydney, and you know, I've had like ongoing kind of connection with him, and you know, he actually made an interesting film about his family and the fire experience.
A lot of your photos are not portraits; they are, for example, your Jangal project. Jangal spelt DZHANGAL. Right. Which was the camp in Calais. Is that where the jungle word came from, the Calais jungle?
Yeah. So that's the origin of the word. It means forest in Pashtun. And that's apparently the origin of the word the jungle camp.
Ah, I did not know that. And what you've got are images of the things that people have left behind, which are incredibly poignant. We have on our website cards that people have abandoned, and you, this is a whole project for you. You went and collected things people left behind, and they are now, I don't know where they are, somewhere in London, and they are being or have been exhibited.
Yes, I actually was commissioned to lead a kind of collaborative photography workshop in the jungle camp. And, you know, so I was teaching people who were there, I was teaching photography. And truthfully, the workshop was a disaster for all kinds of reasons. It was poorly planned. And I was at a moment of kind of severe depression about all the mistakes we'd made. And in a sense, it was not an appropriate place to be doing what we were trying to do. But I also felt very kind of upset about the role of photography in that situation, where photography kind of became the enemy of the people living in the camp.
Because why?
Well, on one level, it identified people who didn't want to be identified. And they were, I mean, essentially it was a camp of people who were trying to cross to, you know, cross the English Channel to, you know, claim asylum in the UK, and they didn't want to claim asylum elsewhere in Europe. And potentially if they were identified, it could, you know, jeopardize their asylum claims. I think there were a lot of problems with the depiction of people. And the idea of the workshop had been that somehow that they would photograph themselves, but actually they were also causing them to some extent endanger themselves in those situations. It was a workshop which didn't work out. And I felt I wanted to try to tell the story of the place, but not through photographing people. And I just began to collect objects, and I all kinds of things from, you know, tear gas canisters, which were, you know, the result of confrontations with the police, to kids' books. And it became an obsession. And I was doing some work with an organization which was also doing kind of art workshops in the jungle camps. So I was there on numerous occasions, and I collected a lot of objects. I brought them back to the UK. And then I set about photographing them in a forensic manner as if they were important archaeological items. So I made a set of photographs, often very precise, kind of almost scientific photographs of these objects, inspired by Irving Penn's photographs of cigarette stumps from the cities, from the streets of New York. I ended up doing a big exhibition of which combined the actual objects and photographs of them. And I was actually, this was picked up, but I didn't realize, but there's actually a movement of contemporary archaeology, you know, which is called, like, the archaeology of now, you know, of recent things. And some, you know, Dan Hicks, who's the head of archaeology at Oxford University, he was very taken by the whole project. And as a result of that all, you know, the kind of nearly 6,000 objects that I collected are now being stored as part of the Museum of London Archaeology Collection.
Good Lord.
So I mean, these things often, you know, you start things, which are, you know, and a lot of, when I began doing this, my, you know, certainly my wife and lots of people around me thought I was completely mad. But, you know, I produced a book called Jungle. It was a big exhibition, which is shown in a few places. And, I feel quite proud of that work in the end.
Is it part of the theme of activism?
Well, I guess it was. I was making a statement about the place in quite a, I suppose, quite an unusual sort of way. Mm. You know, it was. I guess a lot of my work sits somewhere in the strange, you know, in the middle of a triangle, you know, if you kind of somewhere between activism and art, you know, it was definitely was quite a conceptual art response as well. I think people struggle because I don't fit into kind of neat categories. You know, I'm not quite a documentary photographer. I'm not quite a photojournalist. I'm not quite an artist. I'm not quite an activist. You know, I'm in the kind of gray areas between all of those.
Seems to have worked for you, Gideon.
Well, I guess so. I mean, it's a strange position to be, but I am kind of happy that I'm able to continue making work.
Where were you when COVID settled down in around?
I was actually working in Australia, and I was photographing, you know, the aftermath of the fires, the terrible fires in Australia, and as I was working, the headlines were getting kind of more and more hectic every day. So I had been meant to be flying back, you know, back from Australia via South Africa. I was meant to be running a workshop in South Africa. But suddenly things changed very quickly. So I had to, you know, fly back directly to the UK. And I think, you know, it's just a couple of days later, you know, kind of all the flights were cut off. So I escaped being kind of trapped in Australia for 2 years.
So did you have a COVID project?
I actually have had two COVID projects. They're not that available on my website, but one is on The Guardian. The one project I did in the early days, I did a series. I'm very actually interested in the idea at the moment of the fixed frame, of setting up a frame and letting life move past the frame. So at the start of COVID, there's a kind of market close to where I live in Hackney called Ridley Road Market. And I established a frame, like the frame, you know, looking down the market. And then I did a set of portraits of people just wearing masks. I did interviews and portraits of, and it was the start of things where people didn't quite know what to do. And wearing a mask was a sign of concern, you know, and of taking it seriously. So people who walked past me wearing masks, I approached and asked if I could take their photograph. So I did about 250 different portraits of people in the exact same frame, exact same position. And I always went sort of late afternoon to have a kind of similar kind of light. So it was just a set of portraits. And I called it 2 meters because actually part of the reason I chose that place is that the local council had put these kind of red lines down the street and written all the way down the street, 2 meters, you know, just the idea that you had to keep 2 meters apart from people. I mean, it's only kind of 2 years ago, but it seems like another world.
Yeah, Boris Johnson obviously didn't spot that.
I know. And then, he didn't take that seriously. There was such a kind of, you know, appalling kind of behavior going on in Boris Johnson's government. But that's another story. But my second project, if copped on, was kind of happened later on in the kind of second winter of COVID, which was a pretty bleak moment when it just was seemed to be going on indefinitely. And I have a small garden, and that my neighbors next door had a big plane tree, have a big plane tree, and it was coppiced. They coppiced it. They cut all, well, not coppiced, I think I've forgotten the word for it.
Pollarded or something.
That's it, pollarded. But you brilliant. Pollarded the tree, all the branches were cut off. And that just felt a little bit like how my life felt at that point. So again, I set up a set, I got a tripod, I set my kind of camera, my tripod up, and I got a fixed position for my tripod. And I photographed that tree through the year. You know, so it was at first completely barren, and then you gradually see kind of leaves and life coming back to the tree.
Nice.
Yeah, so those are my, you know, those were my kind of, I guess, two main lockdown projects. But one thing I can tell you about lockdown projects is nobody wants to see lockdown projects now.
No, that's right.
Everybody's sick and tired of lockdown. No. Nobody wants to know about your lockdown projects.
I'm sure. However, I'm sure that your pollarded tree will speak volumes about everything else in life. It's very nice to talk to you, Gideon. Thank you. Gideon Mendel. Whose some of his work entitled Submerged Portraits feature in the Auckland Festival of Photography. They're on the Queen's Wharf fence, and also there's a video work screening outside the Auckland Central Library. And if you can't get there, you can see some of them on our webpage.